been hiding a biological weapons program that included anthrax and botulinum toxin. To keep Saddam in check, the UN imposed strict economic sanctions. But as outrage over Iraq's invasion of Kuwait faded, the world's attention drifted. Saddam diverted nearly $2 billion from the Oil for Food program, which the UN had created to provide for the basic humanitarian needs of innocent Iraqis, to enrich his cronies and reconstitute his military strength, including programs related to weapons of mass destruction. As children starved, he launched a propaganda campaign blaming sanctions for the suffering. By 1998, Saddam had persuaded key trading partners like Russia and France to lobby the UN to loosen the restrictions. Then he forced the UN weapons inspectors to leave the country. The problem was clear. Saddam had never verified that he had destroyed all of his weapons from the Gulf War. With the inspectors gone, the world was blind to whether he had restarted his programs. The Clinton administration responded by launching Operation Desert Fox, a four-day bombing campaign conducted jointly with Great Britain and aimed at degrading Saddam's WMD capabilities. In a primetime address from the Oval Office in December 1998, President Clinton explained, "The hard fact is that so long as Saddam remains in power, he threatens the well-being of his people, the peace of his region, the security of the world. The best way to end that threat once and for all is with a new Iraqi government, a government ready to live in peace with its neighbors, a government that respects the rights of its people. Heavy as they are, the costs of action must be weighed against the price of inaction. If Saddam defies the world and we fail to respond, we will face a far greater threat in the future. Saddam will strike again at his neighbors. He will make war on his own people. And mark my words, he will develop weapons of mass destruction. He will deploy them, and he will use them." The same year, Congress overwhelmingly passed and President Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act. The law declared a new official policy of the United States to support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq and to promote the emergence of a democratic government. By early 2001, Saddam Hussein was waging a low-grade war against the United States. In 1999 and 2000, his forces had fired 700 times at our pilots patrolling the no-fly zones. For my first 8 months in office, my policy focused on tightening the sanctions, or as Colin Powell put it, keeping Saddam in his box. Then 9/11 hit, and we had to take a fresh look at every threat in the world. There were state sponsors of terror. There were sworn enemies of America. There were hostile governments that threatened their neighbors. There were nations that violated international demands. There were dictators who repressed their people. And there were regimes that pursued WMD. Iraq combined all those threats. Saddam Hussein didn't just sympathize with terrorists. He had paid the families of Palestinian suicide bombers and given sanctuary to terrorists like Abu Nidal, who led attacks that killed 19 people at an Israeli Airlines ticket counters in Rome and Vienna, and Abu Abbas, who hijacked the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro and murdered an elderly, wheelchair-bound American. Saddam Hussein wasn't just a sworn enemy of America. He had fired at our aircraft, issued a statement praising 9/11, and made an assassination attempt on a former president, my father. Saddam Hussein didn't just threaten his neighbors. He had invaded two of them, Iran in the 1980s and Kuwait in the 1990s. Saddam Hussein didn't just violate international demands. He had defied 16 UN resolutions dating back to the Gulf War. Saddam Hussein didn't just rule brutally. He and his henchmen had tortured innocent people, raped political opponents in front of their families, scalded dissidents with acid, and dumped tens of thousands of Iraqis into mass graves. In 2000, Saddam's government decreed that people who criticized the president or his family would have their tongues slashed out. Later that year, an Iraqi obstetrician was beheaded on charges of prostitution. The woman's true crime was speaking out about corruption in the Iraqi health ministry. Saddam Hussein just didn't pursue weapons of mass destruction. He had used them. He deployed mustard gas and nerve agents against the Iranians and massacred more than 5,000 innocent civilians in a 1988 chemical attack on the Kurdish village of Halabja. Nobody knew what Saddam had done with his biological and chemical stockpiles, especially after he booted inspectors out of the country. But after reviewing the information, virtually every major intelligence agency in the world had reached the same conclusion. Saddam had WMD in his arsenal and the capacity to produce more. One intelligence report summarized the problem. Since the end of inspections in 1998, Saddam has maintained the chemical weapons effort, energized the missile program, made a bigger investment in biological weapons, and has begun to try to move forward in the nuclear area. Before 9/11, Saddam was a problem America might have been able to manage. Through the lens of the post-9/11 world, my view changed. I had just witnessed the damage inflicted by 19 fanatics armed with box cutters. I could only imagine the destruction possible if an enemy dictator passed his WMD to terrorists. With threats flowing into the Oval Office daily, many of them about chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, that seemed like a frighteningly real possibility. The stakes were too high to trust the dictator's word against the weight of the evidence and the consensus of the world. The lesson of 9/11 was that if we waited for a danger to fully materialize, we would have waited too long. I reached a decision. We would confront the threat from Iraq one way or another. My first choice was to use diplomacy. Unfortunately, our track record with Iraq was not encouraging. We maintained a bilateral relationship with Baghdad in the 1980s. We obtained UN Security Council resolutions in the 1990s. Despite our engagement, Saddam grew only more belligerent. If diplomacy was going to succeed, we needed a fundamentally different approach. We believed Saddam's weakness was that he loved power and would do anything to keep it. If we could convince him we were serious about removing his regime, there was a chance he would give up his WMD, end his support for terror, stop threatening his neighbors, and over time, respect the human rights of his people. The odds of success were long, but given the alternative, it was worth the effort. The approach was called coercive diplomacy. Coercive diplomacy with Iraq consisted of two tracks. One was to rally a coalition of nations to make clear that Saddam's defiance of his international obligations was unacceptable. The other was to develop a credible military option that could be used if he failed to comply. These tracks would run parallel at first. As the military option grew more visible and more advanced, the tracks would converge. Our maximum leverage would come just before they intersected. That would be the moment of decision. And ultimately, it would be Saddam Hussein's decision to make. In February 2001, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and his wife Cherie came to visit Laura and me at Camp David. Tony was the first foreign leader we invited, a tribute to the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. I wasn't sure what to expect from Tony. I knew he was a left-of-center Labor Party prime minister and a close friend of Bill Clinton's. I quickly found he was candid, friendly, and engaging. There was no stuffiness about Tony and Cherie. After dinner, we decided to watch a movie. When they agreed on Meet the Parents, a comedy starring Robert De Niro and Ben Stiller, Laura and I knew the Bushes and Blairs would get along. Tony and I talked through the major issues of the day. He gave me a briefing on the politics of Europe. We discussed our common goals to expand free trade, relieve suffering in Africa, and address the violence in the Holy Land. We didn't spend much time on the social issues. That was left for Cherie and me. In the summer of 2001, the Blairs invited Laura and me to Chequers, the storied country estate of the British Prime Minister. Chequers is a large, creaky house filled with rustic, comfortable furniture and portraits of former prime ministers. Rather than throw a formal reception, the Blairs arranged a cozy family dinner with their four children, including little Leo, age 14 months. About halfway through the meal, the death penalty came up. Cherie made clear she didn't agree with my position. Tony looked a little uncomfortable. I listened to her views and then defended mine. I told her I believed the death penalty, when properly administered, could save lives by deterring crime. A talented lawyer whom I grew to respect, Cherie rebutted my arguments. At one point, Laura and I overheard Ewan, the Blair's bright 17-year-old son, say, "Give the man a break, Mother." The more time we spent together, the more I respected Tony. Over the years, he grew into my closest partner and best friend on the world stage. He came to the United States for meetings more than 30 times during my presidency. Laura and I visited him in Northern Ireland, Scotland, and London. In November 2003, Tony and Cherie invited us to their home in Trimden Colliery, an old mining area in the countryside. They served us a cup of tea in the red brick Victorian and took us to a town pub, the Dun Cow Inn. We ate fish and chips with mushy peas, which I washed down with a non-alcoholic Bitburger lager. After lunch, we dropped by a local school and watched a soccer practice, known as football to our hosts. The people were decent and welcoming, aside from the protester who carried a sign that read, "Mad Cowboy Disease." Tony had a quick laugh and a sharp wit. After our first meeting, a British reporter asked what we had in common. I quipped, "We both use Colgate toothpaste." Tony fired back, "They're going to wonder how you know that, George." When he addressed the joint session of Congress in 2003, Tony brought up the War of 1812, when British troops burned the White House. "I know this is kind of late," he said, "but sorry." Unlike many politicians, Tony was a strategic thinker who could see beyond the immediate horizon. As I would come to learn, he and I were kindred spirits in our faith in the transformative power of liberty. In the final week of my presidency, I was proud to make him one of the few foreign leaders to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Above all, Tony Blair had courage. No issue demonstrated it more clearly than Iraq. Like me, Tony considered Saddam a threat the world could not tolerate after 9/11. The British were targets of the extremists. They had extensive intelligence on Saddam, and they understood in a personal way the menace he posed. Saddam was shooting at their pilots, too. If we had to remove Saddam from power, Tony and I would have an obligation to help the Iraqi people replace Saddam's tyranny with a democracy. The transformation would have an impact beyond Iraq's borders. The Middle East was the center of a global ideological struggle. On one side were decent people who wanted to live in dignity and peace. On the other were extremists who sought to impose their radical views through violence and intimidation. They exploited conditions of hopelessness and repression to recruit and spread their ideology. The best way to protect our country in the long run was to counter their dark vision with a more compelling alternative. That alternative was freedom. People who could choose their leaders at the ballot box would be less likely to turn to violence. Young people growing up with hope in the future would not search for meaning in the ideology of terror. Once liberty took root in one society, it could spread to others. In April 2002, Tony and Cherie visited Laura and me in Crawford. Tony and I talked about coercive diplomacy as a way to address the threat from Iraq. Tony suggested that we seek a UN Security Council resolution that presented Saddam with a clear ultimatum: allow weapons inspectors back into Iraq or face serious consequences. I didn't have a lot of faith in the UN. The Security Council had passed 16 resolutions against Saddam to no avail. But I agreed to consider his idea. I raised Iraq with other world leaders throughout 2002. Many shared my assessment of the threat, including John Howard of Australia, Jose Maria Aznar of Spain, Junichiro Koizumi of Japan, Jan-Peter Balkenende of the Netherlands, Anders Fogh Rasmussen of Denmark, Alexander Kwasniewski of Poland, and most other leaders in Central and Eastern Europe. It was revealing that some of the strongest advocates for confronting Saddam were those with the freshest memories of tyranny. In the late 1930s, the Western democracies hesitated in the face of danger. Prime Minister Siim Kallas of Estonia, a former Soviet republic, told me. As a consequence, we fell under dictatorships, and many people lost their lives. Action is sometimes necessary. Other leaders had a different outlook. Vladimir Putin didn't consider Saddam a threat. It seemed to me that part of the reason was Putin didn't want to jeopardize Russia's lucrative oil contracts. France also had significant economic interests in Iraq. I was not surprised when Jacques Chirac told me he would support intrusive weapons inspections, but cautioned against threatening military force. The problem with his logic was that without a credible threat of force, the diplomacy would be toothless once again. One of the toughest leaders to figure out was Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder of Germany. I met with Gerhard 5 times in 2001. He was relaxed, affable, and interested in strengthening our bilateral relationship. I appreciated his leadership on Afghanistan, especially his willingness to host the Loya Jirga in Bonn. I discussed Iraq with Gerhard during his visit to the White House on January 31, 2002. In my State of the Union address 2 days earlier, I had outlined the threats posed by Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world, I said. The media seized on the phrase, axis of evil. They took the line to mean that the three countries had formed an alliance. That missed the point. The axis I referred to was the link between the governments that pursued WMD and the terrorists who could use those weapons. There was a larger point in the speech that no one could miss. I was serious about dealing with Iraq. In a small Oval Office meeting, joined by Condi Rice and Andy Card, I told the German Chancellor I was determined to make diplomacy work. I hoped he would help. I also assured him our words would not be empty. The military option was my last choice, but I would use it if necessary. What is true of Afghanistan is true of Iraq, he said. Nations that sponsor terror must face consequences. If you make it fast and make it decisive, I will be with you. I took that as a statement of support. But when the German elections arrived later that year, Schroeder had a different take. He denounced the possibility of using force against Iraq. His justice minister said, Bush wants to divert attention from domestic political problems. Hitler also did that. I was shocked and furious. It was hard to think of anything more insulting than being compared to Hitler by a German official. I continued to work with Gerhard Schroeder on areas of mutual interest. But as someone who valued personal diplomacy, I put a high premium on trust. Once that trust was violated, it was hard to have a constructive relationship again. 2 months after 9/11, I asked Don Rumsfeld to review the existing battle plans for Iraq. We needed to develop the coercive half of coercive diplomacy. Don tasked General Tommy Franks with updating the plans. Just after Christmas 2001, Tommy came to Crawford to brief me on Iraq. The plan on the shelf required a 6-month buildup and 400,000 troops. The experience in Afghanistan was at the forefront of our minds. Thanks to new technology and innovative planning, we had destroyed the Taliban and closed the Al-Qaeda camps using far fewer troops. We were not viewed as occupiers by the Afghan people. Tommy told the national security team that he was working to apply the same concept of a light footprint to Iraq. He envisioned a fast invasion from Kuwait in the south, Saudi Arabia and Jordan in the west, and Turkey in the north. If we have multiple, highly skilled, special operations forces identifying targets for precision-guided munitions, we will need fewer conventional ground forces, he said. That's an important lesson learned from Afghanistan. I had a lot of concerns. I wanted to know how fast our troops could move and what kind of basing we would need. As in Afghanistan, I was concerned about starvation of the local population and asked what we could do to protect innocent life. I worried about Saddam sabotaging the oil fields or firing missiles at Israel. My biggest fear was that he would use biological or chemical weapons against our troops, our allies, or Iraqi civilians. I asked the team to keep working on the plan. We should remain optimistic that diplomacy and international pressure will succeed in disarming the regime, I said at the end of the meeting. But we cannot allow weapons of mass destruction to fall into the hands of terrorists. I will not allow that to happen. Between December 2001 and August 2002, I met or spoke with Tommy more than a dozen times. The plan was getting better, but I wasn't satisfied. I wanted to make sure we had thought through as many contingencies as possible. I asked Don and Tommy a lot of questions that started with, "What if Saddam decides to..." One scenario I brought up frequently was Saddam consolidating his forces in Baghdad and engaging our troops in bloody urban combat. I remembered the battle in Somalia in 1993 and did not want to see that repeated in Iraq. Tommy and his team didn't have all the answers on the spot, and I didn't expect them to. But they were working hard to refine the plan, and every iteration they brought me was an improvement on the previous version. The updated plan Tommy presented in the Situation Room on August 5, 2002, resolved several key concerns. We lined up basing and overflight permission from leaders in the Gulf. Tommy had devised a plan for special operations to secure suspected WMD sites, Iraq's southern oil fields, and Scud missile launchers. He had also designed a massive aerial bombardment that would make it costly for Saddam's elite Republican Guard units to remain in the capital, reducing the chances of a Fortress Baghdad scenario. "Mr. President," Tommy said in his Texas drawl, "this is going to be shock and awe." There were plenty of issues left to resolve. We all worried about the possibility of Saddam launching a biological or chemical attack on our troops. So the military was in the process of procuring hazmat suits. We'd gradually increased the level of troops and equipment in Kuwait under the guise of training and other routine exercises, which would make it possible to begin combat operations rapidly if I gave the order to launch. Joint Chiefs Chairman Dick Myers talked about the importance of persuading Turkey to open its territory so we could establish a northern front. George Tenet raised concern about a broader regional war in which Syria attacked Israel, or Iran directed its proxy terrorist group, Hezbollah, to foment instability. Don Rumsfeld pointed out that a war could destabilize Jordan and Saudi Arabia, that America could get stuck in a manhunt for Saddam, and that Iraq could fracture after liberation. Those potential scenarios were sobering. But so were the briefings we were receiving. A report in July read, "Iraq has managed to preserve and in some cases even enhance the infrastructure and expertise necessary for WMD production." Another briefing warned that Saddam's regime was almost certainly working to produce the causative agent for anthrax, along with botulinum toxin, aflatoxin, and ricin. It continued, "Unmanned aerial vehicles gave Baghdad a more lethal means to deliver biological weapons." It went on ominously, "Experience shows that Saddam produces weapons of mass destruction to use, not just to deter." In the summer of 2002, I received a startling piece of news. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, an al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist who had experimented with biological weapons in Afghanistan, was operating a lab in northeastern Iraq. Suspect facility in this area may be producing poisons and toxins for terrorist use, the briefing read. Al-Zarqawi is an active terrorist planner who has targeted U.S. and Israeli interests. Sensitive reporting from a classified service indicates that Al-Zarqawi has been directing efforts to smuggle an unspecified chemical material originating in northern Iraq into the United States. We couldn't say for sure whether Saddam knew Zarqawi was in Iraq. We did have intelligence indicating that Zarqawi had spent 2 months in Baghdad, receiving medical treatment, and that other al-Qaeda operatives had moved to Iraq. The CIA had worked with a major Arab intelligence service to get Saddam to find and extradite Zarqawi. He refused. The question was whether to bomb the poisons lab in the summer of 2002. We held a series of NSC meetings on the topic. General Dick Myers talked through the options: Tomahawk missiles, a B-2 bomber strike, or a covert ground raid. Dick Cheney and Don saw Zarqawi as a clear threat and argued that taking him out would reinforce the doctrine that America would not tolerate safe havens for terror. Colin and Condi felt a strike on the lab would create an international firestorm and disrupt our efforts to build a coalition to confront Saddam, especially our attempt to recruit Turkey, which was highly sensitive about any activity in northeastern Iraq. This would be viewed as a unilateral start to the war in Iraq, Cullen said. I faced a dilemma. If America was hit with a biological attack from Iraq, I would be responsible for not having taken out the threat when we had the chance. On the other hand, bombing the camp could undermine diplomacy and trigger a military conflict. I told the intelligence community to keep a close eye on the facility. For the time being, I decided to continue on the diplomatic track. But one thing was clear to me. Iraq was a serious threat, growing more dangerous by the day. I spent much of August 2002 in Crawford, a good place to reflect on the next decision I faced, how to move forward on the diplomatic track. One option was to seek a UN resolution calling on Saddam to readmit weapons inspectors. The other was to issue an ultimatum demanding that he disarm and rally a coalition to remove him if he did not comply. From a legal standpoint, a resolution was unnecessary. 3 years earlier, President Clinton and our NATO allies had removed the dictator Slobodan Milosevic from power in Serbia without an explicit UN resolution. Dick and Don argued we didn't need one for Iraq either. After all, we already had 16. They believed that going to the UN would trigger a long bureaucratic process that would leave Saddam even more dangerous. I shared that concern. On the other hand, almost every ally I consulted, even staunch advocates of confronting Saddam, like Prime Minister John Howard of Australia, told me a UN resolution was essential to win public support in their countries. Colin agreed. The day before I left for Crawford, I asked him to meet with me privately in the treaty room. Colin was more passionate than I had seen him at any NSC meeting. He told me a UN resolution was the only way to get any support from the rest of the world. He went on to say that if we did take out Saddam, the military strike would be the easy part. Then, as Colin put it, America would own Iraq. We would be responsible for helping a fractured country rebuild. I listened carefully and shared Colin's concern. It was another reason I hoped that diplomacy would work. That summer, the possibility of war had become an all-consuming news story in Washington. Reporters asked frequently whether I had a war plan on my desk. On August 15th, I opened the Wall Street Journal to find a column by Brent Scowcroft, Dad's national security advisor. It was headlined, "Don't Attack Saddam." Brent argued that war with Iraq would distract from the war on terror and could unleash an Armageddon in the Middle East. His conclusion was that we should be pressing the United Nations Security Council to insist on an effective, no-notice inspection regime for Iraq. That was a fair recommendation, but I was angry that Brent had chosen to publish his advice in the newspaper instead of sharing it with me. I called Dad. "Son, Brent is a friend," he assured me. That might be true, but I knew critics would later exploit Brent's article if the diplomatic track failed. Some in Washington speculated that Brent's op-ed was Dad's way of sending me a message on Iraq. That was ridiculous. Of all people, Dad understood the stakes. If he thought I was handling Iraq wrong, he damn sure would have told me himself. On Saturday, September 7th, 2002, I convened a meeting of the National Security Team at Camp David to finalize my decision on the resolution. 51 weeks earlier, we had gathered in Laurel Lodge to plan the war in Afghanistan. Now, we sat in the same room, trying to find a way to remove the threat in Iraq without war. I gave everyone on the team a chance to make their arguments. Dick Cheney recommended that we restate the case against Saddam, give him 30 to 60 days to come clean, and then disarm him by force if he refused to comply. "It is time to act," Dick said. "We can't delay for another year. An inspection regime does not solve our problem." Colin pushed for the UN resolution. "If we take the case to the UN, we can get allies to join. If not, it will be hard to act unilaterally. We won't have the international support we need to execute the military plan." After listening to the options one last time, I made a decision. We would seek a resolution. "There's ambiguity in the international community's view of Saddam," I said, "and we need to clear it up. Either he will come clean about his weapons, or there will be war." I told the team I would deliver that message in a speech to the United Nations the following week. I would remind the UN that Saddam's defiance was a threat to the credibility of the institution. Either the words of the Security Council would be enforced, or the UN would exist only as a useless international body, like the League of Nations. Tony Blair came to dinner that night at Camp David. He was pleased when I told him I was planning to ask the UN for the resolution. "Many opponents wish we would just be unilateral. Then they could complain," he said. "But you were calling their bluff." We both understood what the decision meant. Once we laid out our position at the UN, we had to be willing to follow through with the consequences. If diplomacy failed, there would be only one option left. "I don't want to go to war," I told Tony, "but I will do it." Tony agreed. After the meeting, I told Alistair Campbell, one of Tony's top aides, "Your man has got cojones." I'm not sure how that translated to the refined ears of 10 Downing Street, but to anyone from Texas, its meaning was clear. "All the world now faces a test," I told UN delegates on September 12, 2002. "And the United Nations, a difficult and defining moment. Are Security Council resolutions to be honored and enforced, or cast aside without consequence? Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant?" Delivering the speech was a surreal experience. The delegates sat silent, almost frozen in place. It was like speaking to a wax museum. The response outside the chamber was encouraging. Allies thanked me for respecting the UN and accepting their advice to seek a resolution. Many at home appreciated that I had challenged the UN. An editorial in the Washington Post read, "If the United Nations remains passive in the face of this long-standing and flagrant violation of its authority in a matter involving weapons of mass destruction, it certainly will risk the irrelevance of which Mr. Bush warned." While the UN debate unfolded, we went to work on another resolution, a congressional war authorization. As part of the debate, leaders on Capitol Hill asked the intelligence community to prepare a national intelligence estimate, analyzing Saddam's WMD programs. The CIA compiled the NIE using much of the same intelligence it had been showing to me for the past 18 months. In a summary sentence later declassified, the NIE concluded, Baghdad has chemical and biological weapons, as well as missiles, with ranges in excess of UN restrictions. If left unchecked, it probably will have a nuclear weapon during this decade. The intelligence had an impact on members of Congress. Senator John Kerry said, When I vote to give the President of the United States the authority to use force, if necessary, to disarm Saddam Hussein, it is because I believe that a deadly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in his hands is a threat, and a grave threat. Senator Jay Rockefeller, a respected Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, followed up. Saddam's existing biological and chemical weapons capabilities pose real threats to America today, tomorrow. He could make these weapons available to many terrorist groups, third parties, which have contact with his government. Those groups, in turn, could bring those weapons into the United States and unleash a devastating attack against our citizens. I fear that greatly. Senator Chuck Hagel, a Nebraska Republican, supported the resolution. He said, The risks of an action are too high. We are elected to solve problems, not just debate them. The time has come to chart a new course in Iraq and in the Middle East. On October 11, 2002, the Senate passed the resolution 77-23. The House passed it 296-133. Both margins were larger than those of the votes for the Gulf War. The resolution garnered votes from prominent Democrats, including House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, and Senators Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, John Kerry, John Edwards, and Harry Reid. Some members of Congress would later claim they were not voting to authorize war, but only to continue diplomacy. They must not have read the resolution. Its language was unmistakable. The president is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, and enforce all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions regarding Iraq. The decisive vote at the UN came on November 8th. Colin had been horse trading on minor issues, but he stayed tough on the provisions holding Saddam to account. The question was whether the resolution would have the votes. We needed 9 of the 15 Security Council members without a veto from France, Russia, or China. We had been burning up the phone lines, trying to get everyone on board. Shortly after the Security Council vote, the phone in the Oval Office rang. Hey, boss, Colin said. We got it done. The vote was unanimous, 15-0. Not only had France voted for the resolution, but so had Russia, China, and Syria. The world was now on record. Saddam had a final opportunity to comply with his obligation to disclose and disarm. If he did not, he would face serious consequences. Under the terms of UN Security Council Resolution 1441, Iraq had 30 days to submit a currently accurate, full, and complete declaration of all WMD-related programs. The resolution made clear the burden of proof rested with Saddam. The inspectors did not have to prove that he had weapons. He had to prove that he did not. When the deadline arrived on December 7th, Saddam submitted his report. I viewed it as a key test. If he came forward with honest admissions, it would send a signal that he understood the message the world was sending. Instead, he submitted reams of irrelevant paperwork clearly designed to deceive. Hans Blix, the mild-mannered Swedish diplomat who led the UN inspections team, later called it rich in volume but poor in information. Joe Lieberman was more succinct. He said the declaration was a 12,000-page, 100-pound lie. If Saddam continued his pattern of deception, the only way to keep the pressure on Iraq would be to present some of the evidence ourselves. I asked George Tenet and his capable deputy, John McLaughlin, to brief me on what intelligence we could declassify to explain Iraq's WMD programs. A few days before Christmas, John walked me through their first effort. It was not very convincing. I thought back to CIA briefings I had received. The NIE that concluded Saddam had biological and chemical weapons, and the data the CIA had provided for my UN speech in September. Surely we can do a better job of explaining the evidence against Saddam, I said. George Tenet agreed. It's a slam dunk, he said. I believed him. I had been receiving intelligence briefings on Iraq for nearly 2 years. The conclusion that Saddam had WMD was nearly a universal consensus. My predecessor believed it. Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill believed it. Intelligence agencies in Germany, France, Great Britain, Russia, China, and Egypt believed it. As the German ambassador to the United States, not a supporter of war, later put it, I think all of our governments believe that Iraq has produced weapons of mass destruction, and that we have to assume that they still have weapons of mass destruction. If anything, we worried that the CIA was underestimating Saddam, as it had before the Gulf War. In retrospect, of course, we all should have pushed harder on the intelligence and revisited our assumptions. But at the time, the evidence and the logic pointed in the other direction. If Saddam doesn't actually have WMD, I asked myself, why on earth would he subject himself to a war he will almost certainly lose? Every Christmas during my presidency, Laura and I invited our extended family to join us at Camp David. We were happy to continue the tradition started by Mother and Dad. We cherished the opportunities to relax with them, Laura's mom, Barbara and Jenna, and my brothers and sister and their families. We loved to watch the children's pageant at the Camp David Chapel, and to sing carols with military personnel and their families. One of the highlights was an annual pink elephant gift exchange, in which my teenage nieces and nephews were not above pilfering the latest iPod or other coveted items from the President of the United States. In later years, we started a tradition of making donations in another family member's name. Jeb and Doro donated books to the library aboard the USS George H.W. Bush. Marvin and his wife, Margaret, donated a communion chalice to the Camp David Chapel on behalf of Laura and me. We gave a gift to the Dorothy Walker Bush Pavilion at the Southern Maine Medical Center in Mother and Dad's name. Amid the Christmas celebrations in 2002, Dad and I talked about Iraq. For the most part, I didn't seek Dad's advice on major issues. He and I both understood that I had access to more and better information than he did. Most of our conversations were for me to reassure him that I was doing fine and for him to express his confidence and love. Iraq was one issue where I wanted to know what he thought. I told Dad I was praying we could deal with Saddam peacefully, but was preparing for the alternative. I walked him through the diplomatic strategy, the solid support from Blair, Howard, and Athnar, the uncertainty with Chirac and Schroeder, and my efforts to rally the Saudis, Jordanians, Turks, and others in the Middle East. He shared my hope that diplomacy would succeed. You know how tough war is, son, and you've got to try everything you can to avoid war, he said. But if the man won't comply, you don't have any other choice. Shortly after New Year's, I sent Barbara and Jenna a letter at college. I am working hard to keep the peace and avoid a war, I wrote. I pray that the man in Iraq will disarm in a peaceful way. We are putting pressure on him to do just that, and much of the world is with us. As 2003 began, it became increasingly clear that my prayer would not be answered. On January 27th, Hans Blix gave a formal report to the United Nations. His inspections team had discovered warheads that Saddam had failed to declare or destroy, indications of the highly toxic VX nerve agent, and precursor chemicals for mustard gas. In addition, the Iraqi government was defying the inspections process. The regime had violated Resolution 1441 by blocking U-2 flights and hiding 3,000 documents in the home of an Iraqi nuclear official. Iraq appears not to have come to a genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament that was demanded of it, Blix said. I could see what was happening. Saddam was trying to shift the burden of proof from himself to us. I reminded our partners that the UN resolution clearly stated that it was Saddam's responsibility to comply. As Mohammed El-Baradi, director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, explained in late January, the ball is entirely in Iraq's court. Iraq now has to prove that it is innocent. They need to go out of their way to prove through whatever possible means that they have no weapons of mass destruction. In late January, Tony Blair came to Washington for a strategy session. We agreed that Saddam had violated UN Security Council Resolution 1441 by submitting a false declaration. We had ample justification to enforce the serious consequences. But Tony wanted to go back to the UN for a second resolution, clarifying that Iraq had failed to take the final opportunity afforded to it. It's not that we need it, Tony said. A second resolution gives us military and political protection. I dreaded the thought of plunging back into the UN. Dick, Don, and Condi were opposed. Colin told me that we didn't need another resolution and probably couldn't get one. But if Tony wanted a second resolution, we would try. As I see it, the issue of the second resolution is how best to help our friends, I said. The best way to get a second resolution was to lay out the evidence against Saddam. I asked Colin to make the presentation to the UN. He had credibility as a highly respected diplomat, known to be reluctant about the possibility of war. I knew he would do a thorough, careful job. In early February, Colin spent 4 days and four nights at the CIA, personally reviewing the intelligence to ensure he was comfortable with every word in his speech. On February 5th, he took the microphone at the Security Council. The facts on Iraq's behavior, he said, demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort, to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction. Colin's presentation was exhaustive, eloquent, and persuasive. Coming against the backdrop of Saddam's defiance of the weapons inspectors, it had a profound impact on the public debate. Later, many of the assertions in Colin's speech would prove inaccurate. But at the time, his words reflected the considered judgment of intelligence agencies at home and around the world. We are both moral men, Jacques Chirac told me after Colin's speech. But in this case, we see morality differently. I replied politely, but I thought to myself, if a dictator who tortures and gasses his people is not immoral, then who is? 3 days later, Chirac stepped in front of the cameras and said, nothing today justifies war. He, Gerhard Schroeder, and Vladimir Putin issued a joint statement of opposition. All three of them sat on the Security Council. The odds of a second resolution looked bleak. Tony urged that we forge ahead. The stakes are now much higher, he wrote to me on February 19th. It is apparent to me from the EU summit that France wants to make this a crucial test. Is Europe America's partner or competitor? He reminded me we had support from a strong European coalition, including Spain, Italy, Denmark, the Netherlands, Portugal, and all of Eastern Europe. In a recent NATO vote, 15 members of the alliance had supported military action in Iraq, with only Belgium and Luxembourg standing with Germany and France. Portuguese Prime Minister José Barroso spoke for many European leaders when he asked incredulously, "We are faced with the choice of America or Iraq, and we're going to pick Iraq?" Tony and I agreed on a strategy. We would introduce the second resolution at the UN, joined by the visionary leader of Spain, Prime Minister José María Aznar. If we lined up enough yes votes, we might be able to persuade France and Russia to abstain rather than veto. If not, we would pull down the resolution, and it would be clear they had blocked the final diplomatic effort. The second resolution, which we introduced on February 24, 2003, was important for another reason. Tony was facing intense internal pressure on the issue of Iraq, and it was important for him to show that he had exhausted every possible alternative to military force. Factions of the Labour Party had revolted against him. By early March, it wasn't clear if his government could survive. I called Tony and expressed my concern. I told him I'd rather have him drop out of the coalition and keep his government than try to stay in and lose it. "I said I'm with you," Tony answered. I pressed my point again. "I understand that, and that's good of you to say," he replied. "I absolutely believe in this. I will take it up to the very last." I heard an echo of Winston Churchill in my friend's voice. It was a moment of courage that will stay with me forever. At Tony's request, I made one last effort to persuade Mexico and Chile, two wavering Security Council members, to support the second resolution. My first call was to my friend, President Vicente Fox. The conversation got off to an inauspicious start. When I told Vicente I was calling about the UN resolution, he asked which one I meant. "If I can give you some advice," I said, "you should not be seen teaming up with the French." He said he would think about it and get back to me. An hour passed. Then Condi heard from the embassy. Vicente had checked into the hospital for back surgery. I never did hear from him on the issue. My conversation with President Ricardo Lagos of Chile did not go much better. He was a distinguished scholarly man and an effective leader. We had negotiated a free trade agreement that I hoped Congress would approve soon. But public opinion in Chile ran against a potential war, and Ricardo was reluctant to support the resolution. He talked about giving Saddam an additional 2 or 3 weeks. I told him a few more weeks would make no difference. Saddam had already had years to comply. "It is sad it has come down to this," I said. I asked one last time how he planned to vote. He said, "No." As the diplomatic process drifted along, the pressure for action had been mounting. In early 2003, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told me the uncertainty was hurting the economy. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, the kingdom's longtime ambassador to Washington, and a friend of mine since Dad's presidency, came to the Oval Office and told me our allies in the Middle East wanted a decision. Whenever I heard someone claim that we had rushed to war, I thought back to this period. It had been more than a decade since the Gulf War resolutions had demanded that Saddam disarm. Over 4 years since he had kicked out the weapons inspectors, 6 months since I had issued my ultimatum at the UN, 4 months since Resolution 1441 had given Saddam his final opportunity, and 3 months past the deadline to fully disclose his WMD. Diplomacy did not feel rushed. It felt like it was taking forever. Meanwhile, the threats continued. President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt had told Tommy Franks that Iraq had biological weapons and was certain to use them on our troops. He refused to make the allegation in public for fear of inciting the Arab street. But the intelligence from a Middle Eastern leader who knew Saddam well had an impact on my thinking. Just as there were risks to action, there were risks to inaction as well. Saddam with a biological weapon was a serious threat to us all. In the winter of 2003, I sought opinions on Iraq from a variety of sources. I asked for advice from scholars, Iraqi dissidents in exile, and others outside the administration. One of the most fascinating people I met with was Elie Wiesel, the author, Holocaust survivor, and deserving Nobel Peace Prize recipient. Eli is a sober and gentle man, but there was passion in his 74-year-old eyes when he compared Saddam Hussein's brutality to the Nazi genocide. "Mr. President," he said, "you have a moral obligation to act against evil." The force of his conviction affected me deeply. Here was a man who had devoted his life to peace, urging me to intervene in Iraq. As he later explained in an op-ed, "Though I oppose war, I am in favor of intervention. When, as in this case, because of Hussein's equivocations and procrastinations, no other option remains." I've always wondered why many critics of the war did not acknowledge the moral argument made by people like Elie Wiesel. Many of those who demonstrated against military action in Iraq were devoted advocates of human rights, yet they condemned me for using force to remove the man who had gassed the Kurds, mowed down the Shia by helicopter gunship, massacred the Marsh Arabs, and sent tens of thousands to mass graves. I understood why people might disagree on the threat Saddam Hussein posed to the United States, but I didn't see how anyone could deny that liberating Iraq advanced the cause of human rights. With diplomacy faltering, our military planning sessions had increasingly focused on what would happen after the removal of Saddam. In later years, some critics would charge that we failed to prepare for the post-war period. That sure isn't how I remember it. Starting in the fall of 2002, a group led by Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley produced in-depth plans for post-Saddam Iraq. Two of our biggest concerns were starvation and refugees. 60% of Iraqis were dependent on the government as a source of food. An estimated 2 million Iraqis could be displaced from their homes during war. On January 15th, Elliot Abrams, a senior NSC staffer, delivered a detailed briefing on our preparations. "We planned to pre-station food, blankets, medicine, tents, and other relief supplies. We produced maps of where refugees could be sheltered. We deployed experienced humanitarian relief experts to enter Iraq alongside our troops. We had pinpointed the locations of most of Iraq's 55,000 food distribution points and made arrangements with international organizations, including the World Food Program, to make sure plenty of food was available. We also developed plans for long-term reconstruction. We focused on 10 areas: education, health, water and sanitation, electricity, shelter, transportation, governance and rule of law, agriculture, communications, and economic policy. For each, we gathered data, formulated a strategy, and set precise goals. For example, U.S. aid determined that Iraq had 250 non-military general hospitals, 20 military hospitals, 5 medical college hospitals, and 995 civilian medical care centers. Our plan called for surging medical supplies into the country, working to recruit Iraqi doctors and nurses living abroad to return home, training new medical personnel, and ultimately, handing control to a new Iraqi health ministry. One of the toughest questions was how to plan for a post-Saddam political system. Some in the administration suggested that we turn over power immediately to a group of Iraqi exiles. I didn't like the idea. While the exiles had close connections in Washington, I felt strongly that the Iraqis' first leader should be someone they selected. I was mindful of the British experience in Iraq in the 1920s. Great Britain had installed a non-Iraqi king, Faisal, who was viewed as illegitimate and whose appointment stoked resentment and instability. We were not going to repeat that mistake. The other major challenge was how to provide security after Saddam. Some intelligence reports predicted that most of Saddam's army and police would switch sides once the regime was gone. The top commanders, those with innocent blood on their hands, would not be invited to rejoin. But we would draw on the rest of the Saddam-era forces to form the foundation of the new Iraqi military and police. In January 2003, I issued a presidential directive, NSPD 24, creating a new Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance. ORHA was charged with turning our conceptual plans into concrete action. We based the office in the Pentagon so that our civilian efforts in Iraq would run through the same chain of command as our military operations. To lead the office, Don Rumsfeld tapped Jay Garner, a retired general who had coordinated the military's relief effort in northern Iraq in 1991. He recruited a cadre of civilian experts from across the government who would stand by to deploy to Baghdad. By having our plans and personnel ready before the war, I felt we were well prepared. Yet we were aware of our limitations. Our nation-building capabilities were limited, and no one knew for sure what needs would arise. The military had an old adage, "No battle plan survives first contact with the enemy." As we would learn in Iraq, that was doubly true of a plan for the post-war environment. By March 2003, the battle plan was ready. After more than a year of probing and questioning, Tommy Franks and his team had developed an operation that I was confident would overthrow Saddam Hussein swiftly and decisively, while minimizing the loss of American and Iraqi life. The one remaining uncertainty was the role of Turkey. For months, we had been pressing the Turks to give us access to their territory so that we could send 15,000 troops from the 4th Infantry Division to enter Iraq from the north. We promised to provide economic and military aid, help Turkey access key programs from the International Monetary Fund, and maintain our strong support for Turkey's admission to the European Union. At one point, it looked like we would get permission. Prime Minister Abdullah Gül's cabinet approved our request. But when the Turkish parliament held a final vote on March 1st, it came up just short of passage. I was frustrated and disappointed. On one of the most important requests we had ever made, Turkey, our NATO ally, had let America down. Don and Tommy held the 4th Infantry Division in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, where it could deploy through Turkey if the government changed its mind or otherwise joined the invasion from Kuwait. We also planned to deploy 1,000 paratroopers from the 173rd Airborne to the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. This wasn't our first choice, but at least we would have a foothold for a northern front. In the south, we had more than 150,000 American troops on Iraq's border, with some 90,000 more stationed in the Gulf region. I had made it abundantly clear that we would use them if necessary. Coercive diplomacy had brought us to our maximum point of leverage. The military and diplomatic tracks had fully converged. The choice between war and peace belonged to Saddam Hussein alone. For months, the National Security Council had been meeting almost daily to discuss Iraq. I knew where all my advisors stood. Dick Cheney was concerned about the slow diplomatic process. He warned that Saddam Hussein could be using the time to produce weapons, hide weapons, or plot an attack. At one of our weekly lunches that winter, Dick asked me directly,